I want to acknowledge that while we enjoy the presence of everybody that comes to the shiur, but just in case somebody's not able to make it for whatever reason, there is, as you see, a lot of technology taking place in this class more than other classes, microphones and tape recorders and now video cameras. I just want to explain it to you for 1 minute what all this is about. I'm not a movie star, and we're not making a movie of some sort and things like that. But what we are doing to make it easy for people is this class is being simulcasted live over the internet. I'm not telling you to get the internet, but if you have the internet already and you're not planning on getting rid of it, you can go to learntorah.com every Friday at 11:30 and you can watch it live. I know I'm competing against myself because next week nobody will come to the class and everybody will say, we saw you on the internet sitting on the beach and sitting at the bridge game. We put a big screen and watched the rabbi. That wouldn't be so bad either. But just so you know, throughout the year, God willing, the ladies' class on Thursday in Brooklyn, as well as the ladies' class in Deal, will be videoed live, so you could watch it, and it's also archived. So you can go to learntorah.com and watch the old class. It's painful enough, I know, listening to me, but now to look at me as well as to listen. So what do I have to tell you? We're just trying to make it, like I said, a little easier for the people. learntorah.com. We are studying Parashat Masa'eh. This parashah in most years does not get proper credit because it's usually coupled with last week's parashah. Usually we read Matot and Masa'eh together. So it's very rare that Parashat Masa'eh gets its own billing, gets its own week. Being that this year was a leap year, as you know, so a lot of these parashiyot, the order has been affected. So it gives us a chance to talk about our parashah individually. What does the word mas'eh mean? Mas'eh means travelings. If you look at the beginning, the first 50 pesukim, it talks about all the travelings that the Jewish people did in the Midbar. You see, when we left Egypt, we were supposed to go straight into Israel. It should have taken just a few days, maybe 11 days. That's all it takes to walk by foot. You can't hear? I'll put this closer. I'll hold it. It's only 11 days traveling from Israel, from Egypt to Israel. But it took more than 11 days. It took 40 years. So the Torah tells us that we had to stop off at different station stops on the way. There was actually 42 stops before we got to Eretz Yisrael. Our rabbis tell us, Mem Bet Masa'ot. Mem Bet. Mem Bet is 42. 42 station stops on the way. It's like the train to get from Elberon to New York City. The station stops on the way. It stops off at Red Bank, and it stops off in the Matawan, and so on and so forth, until it gets to Newark, and then to New York Penn Station. So when the Jews... What? It's parking? today I have a lot of bosses. Okay. The flower is okay, ladies? I put the flower on here. Where was I? So there's 42 stops on the way. I was once with a great rabbi, actually the rabbi of the Turnberry Synagogue, my dear friend Rabbi Galamidi. We were once together in Miami Beach. So he was telling me, he said a cute line. He said, Mem Bet, which is the 42nd station stop, Mem Bet is also the abbreviations of Miami Beach, Mem Bet. And he said, that's everybody's last stop. The last stop on the train, everybody always ends up at the end in Miami Beach. In any event, the Torah lists that they camped, and then they traveled, and then they camped, and then they traveled. And it tells us once in a while the events that took place. at this place, this event occurred. At that place, this event transpired. And the Torah says when they got to a place called Hor Hahar, what happened at Hor Hahar? It says, well, Hor Hahar is a mountain. It's actually in Jordan. It's the place where Aharon died. And the Torah tells us, "Vayachanu behor hahar bikse eres Edom." It's on the border of the land of Edom. "Vayaal Aharon haKohen el hor hahar," and Aharon the Kohen went up to the mountain. Al pi Hashem, "Vayamotcham," and he died there. "Bishnat ha'arba'im letzet b'nei Yisrael meres Mitzrayim," who was in the 40th year from when the Jews left Egypt. "B'chodesh ha'hamishi," in the 5th month. Be'ehad lachodesh, on the first day of the month. Ve'aharon ben shalosh ve'eslim umad shana b'moto behor hahar. And Aharon was 123 years old when he passed away. And our rabbis are concerned because we know about the death of Aharon already. This was discussed a few parashiyot ago in Parashat Chukat. It told us that he went up to the mountain on Hor Hahar and that he died. Why does the Torah need to tell us again in Parashat Mas'eh not only that he died, but it gives us very interesting details? Number one, it tells us where the mountain was, on the border of Edom. Number two, it tells us the date that he died, on the first day of the 5th month. And furthermore, it tells us how old he was, 123 years old. All this information should have been written the first time when the Torah tells it to us. When the first time the Torah tells us he dies, give me all this information. Why does it wait until our parasha? And I'm going to tell you a very interesting concept. I hope you can understand it. The death of Aharon is not only the death of a human being. Aharon, according to the holy books, actually is a human representation of the Beit HaMikdash. Which means it's possible that you could have the Beit HaMikdash in its structure of bricks, like we had in Jerusalem. But there's also a structure of the Beit HaMikdash in a certain human being that he epitomizes or internalizes the temple. And therefore we have to know, everything is in our Torah. Everything that is going to happen is going to be written in our Torah somewhere. All future events are documented in our Torah. Our Torah can forecast up until the day of Mashiach. If you know how to read it, you know how to access it, you can see all the information. Our rabbis are telling us that the death of Aharon is tantamount to the destruction of the temple. You must keep in mind, Aharon was a Kohen Gadol. He was the manager of the temple. He was the manager of the Mishkan. So therefore, in his death, that represents the destruction of the temple, of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, and the holy temple in Jerusalem. Now ladies, when the second temple was destroyed, who was it destroyed by? It was destroyed by the Romans. Okay, flower time. I said flower and the flowers came. I'm not a prophet, but I knew the flowers are going to get me. Oh, you can put it right over here. That's fine. That's fine. Okay. Is there another one for this side? No. Okay. In any event, when Aharon dies, that is like the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The second temple, mind you, was destroyed by the Romans. The Romans are referred to as Edom. We are still in that exile called Galut Edom. Actually, there are four exiles. One exile was called Bavel. That was the first destruction of the temple. Then you had Madai. That was Ahasuerus. Then you had Yavan. Yavan was the Greeks. And then you had Edom, which is the exile that we've been in now for close to 2,000 years. And I want you to know that that's why the Torah tells us, "Vaya'al Aharon el Hor Hahar," and Aharon went up to Hor Hahar, "Vayamotcham," and he died. And the Torah tells us, where is Hor Hahar? Bikse Eres Edom. It's at the border of the country of Edom, which the Torah is hinting to us that when the Beit HaMikdash is going to be destroyed, it's going to put us into the territory of Edom. We're going to be in that exile. And when did Aharon die? His yahrzeit is on the first day of the fifth month. You know what the fifth month of the year is? Av. Tomorrow we are going to commemorate Rosh Chodesh Av. That is the yahrzeit of Aharon HaKohen. And every year, Parashat Mas'eh will always coincide with Rosh Chodesh Av, with the yahrzeit of Aharon. Because when was the Beit HaMikdash destroyed? The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in the month of Av. And therefore, that was predetermined when Aharon died on Rosh Chodesh Av, in the month that ushers in Jewish tragedy and national pain and suffering. So the Torah is hinting to us, he dies exactly this time of year when we mourn our temple. And the Torah tells us further, Aharon dies in the fifth month, according to the holy books. Every one of our tzaddikim represent another trait. Avram is chesed. Some represent Givurah, some represent Tiferet, some represent Netzach. These are complicated words, but they mean a certain trait of each tzaddik. You know what the trait of Aharon is? Aharon's trait is the fifth trait. The fifth trait is called Hod. Hod is splendor. Aharon represented splendor because not only was he splendid in his eight garments that he wore as the Kohen Gadol. When you looked at Aharon, you saw a beautiful man with the breastplate, with the big hat, with the clothes of the Kohen Gadol that was lechabod u'tefalet. He indeed was Hod. He was the splendor of our religion. And he represents the Beit HaMikdash, which was also the splendor. When people would see the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, even the Goyim marveled by it. It was not only an architectural genius, but it was a place where you basked in the Shekhinah. You saw the splendor of our nation. When Aharon dies, the splendor of our people is gone. When the temple is destroyed, we lose that hod that I'm talking about as well. And since that is the fifth trait, that's why he dies in the fifth month. That's why you'll pay note. On Sukkot, every night we have guests in the Sukkah. On the first night we invite Avraham. On the second night you invite Yitzhak and then Yaakov. And then Moshe and then Aharon. Aharon is invited on the fifth night. He dies in the fifth month. He represents the fifth trait called Hod. And our rabbis tell us in the Torah, it says he lived 123 years. That is very significant. Because if you remember, ladies, the tabernacle, that's the portable Beit HaMikdash that we had in the Midbar. If you stood on the outside of it, it measured 30 amot. Meaning if you took a measuring stick from point A to point B, from beginning to end, it was 30 cubits. It's quite long. But if you entered the Mishkan, it was divided into two parts. The holy was 20 cubits, but the holy of holies was 10 cubits. So it's 30 on the outside, and on the inside it's 20 and 10. 30 is 3. 20 is 2. 10 is 1. Aharon lived 123 years. One representing the 10 of the holy. Two representing the holy of holies. Two representing the 20 of the holy. And three representing the 30 of the whole structure. Which means even the amount of years that he lived corresponds to the measurements of the Mishkan. And therefore look at the divine design of the Torah. When he died in Parashat Chukat, we're mourning the human that died. Aharon dies as a person. He went up to the mountain, he died. In this week's Parashat, we're not mourning the person that died. We're mourning what he represented. We're mourning he represents the Holy Temple. And therefore, what a beautiful coincidence that tomorrow, where we usher in Rosh Chodesh Av, and we read about on his yahrzeit, we're going to take out the Sefer Torah, and read about his death, which talks about the destruction of the temple on the border of Edom that threw us into the exile of Edom, which we are still in, at 123 years old. The dimensions of the Mishkan. But this is what I'm going to tell you now. Towards the end of our parasha, we read an interesting law, a law that you've heard about. A person that murders somebody by mistake, unintentional murder. How does that happen? A person was chopping down a tree. He didn't realize that somebody else was in the field when he was chopping down the tree. Somebody else was in the forest. He didn't pay attention. And when he took the axe and he banged it on the wood, the axe, the metal wasn't fastened properly and it flew off the handle. God forbid it killed somebody. It was unintentional. The law says that all unintentional murders must go into exile. They go to a city of refuge, and they must live in the city of refuge. It's a kapara for them. They have to leave their families. They have to live in exile. How long? Is it a 5-year sentence? Is it a 10-year sentence? Is it a life sentence? The Torah says until the Kohen Gadol dies. Once the Kohen Gadol dies, all people in the city of refuge and exile are free. And the rabbis in the Talmud say, why is it dependent on the Kohen Gadol's death? Why does the freedom of these people in exile depend on the Kohen Gadol dying? So one opinion the Gemara says, because it's his fault. It's his fault, poor guy. What did he do? He wasn't in the field with the axe. He was in the Beit HaMikdash. But the Gemara says he didn't pray hard enough. Because the Kohen Gadol has to pray that there shouldn't be any accidents in the Jewish people. That nobody should die intentionally and unintentionally. And no bad occurrences should happen. And if this bad occurrence happened, that means it's because the Kohen Gadol didn't pray hard enough. So therefore, he's connected to this tragedy. But that's a good answer. But I want to tell you what the Zohar HaKadosh says. You know why it's dependent on the Kohen Gadol? Listen to something fascinating. When a tzaddik dies, it's a great day in the heavens. The heavens are thrilled when the tzaddik goes up to the Shamayim. There's a party that takes place. All the tzaddikim come out like Rabdil. You can imagine when we have a Sefer Torah dedication. So all the Sefarim in the Hechal are so happy. They get a friend. They have a new associate that's going to come visit them and join them in the Holy Hechal. So what do the Sefer Torah do? They ask us, please carry us out so we can greet our new friend. So we can usher him into his new location. They're thrilled. When a tzaddik dies, it's like a Sefer Torah going up to the heaven, to the Holy Ark. And all the tzaddikim come out to greet, and there's a party, and there's dancing, and it's according to the holy books, it's one of the most special moments, maybe not for us on earth. We mourn the death of the tzaddikim, but in Shamayim, oh, it's a big day. As a matter of fact, our custom, the Sefaradim, most days of the year, we ask God forgiveness for our sins. After the Amidah, we say Anna. We bang on our heart. We've sinned, we've done this, we've done that. Supplications. But you know, there are some Hasidim that they never bang their hearts 365 days a year. Why? Because to them, every day is considered a holiday. On holidays, even we don't bang our hearts. It's a holiday, it's a happy day. But to the Ashkenazim, the Hasidim, you pray by some of their shtibles or their synagogue. No, Anna, the whole year long. Why? Because every day they have a calendar where another tzaddik died. And they say it's such a great day. In the heaven, not only on the day he died, but on the anniversary of the tzaddik's death, it's reawakened. They make an anniversary party, so to speak. So they claim that every day in heaven there must have been a tzaddik that died, and therefore it's a happy day. Therefore we never have to bang on the hearts because we're always in a good mood. We're always happy. Okay, it's good. If you pray by the Hasidim, you save 5 or 6 minutes from the prayer because they skip some of the pieces. So the Zohar says like this, on the day that the Kohen Gadol died, it's such a great day in the heaven that they give out some pardons. You know, when the president, when he leaves office at the end of 4 or 8 years, he has a right to pardon certain criminals. That is his right. So in Shamayim, they're in such a good mood. So God says, you know what? We have a tzaddik came to visit us today, the Kohen Gadol, the greatest man. You know what? All those people that are in exile, let them out. Let them out. Birthday present. Let them all go out. You see, when the king is in a good mood, he does things even outside the normal protocol. Because everybody's happy. So you know what? Let them go. Let them enjoy themselves. Today's a big day in the heavens. Let even the people on the earth enjoy. So listen to what I'm telling you now, ladies. When the Kohen Gadol dies, it has the ability to take people that are in exile out. Every single year, when the Yahrzeit of Aharon rolls around on Rosh Chodesh Av, we commemorate the death of the first Kohen Gadol. And on that day there's a tremendous simcha in the heavens. They remember this is the day that Aharon HaKohen came to greet us and visit us. And therefore it's a day where people who are in exile have a chance to get free. Not only personal exiles like the sinner who kills Mishogeg, but people like our nation, national exile. Tomorrow is one of the most auspicious days of the calendar, Rosh Chodesh Av. On that day it's one of the most favorable days where we have a chance to be finally redeemed. Because it is on that day that the Kohen Gadol dies, and on that day everybody in exile goes free. Tomorrow there's a great awakening in the heavens. Where Borei Olam says, oh, the great, the epitome, the paradigm Kohen Gadol, today is his anniversary. And therefore, who's in exile? We have no more cities of refuge, but we are all in exile. Even the Jews in Israel are in exile, as long as our temple is not being rebuilt. And therefore, always this parasha will come out in the beginning of the month of Av, because we want that great death, that Yahrzeit of Aharon, to activate tremendous mercy in heaven, where God will tell us tomorrow on Shabbat, Rosh Chodesh Av, you're all free, go back home, go back to your land, the temple will be rebuilt. So we look forward to this day every single year. Hence the parasha always coincides with that date. So we're very lucky that we're living in this time. Specifically, tomorrow's one of the greatest days of the year. You have to know, in generally speaking, the three Shabbatot of the 3 weeks, the three Shabbats of the 3 weeks between Shabbat Sabbat, Tammuz, and the Shabbat, these are one of the three most holy Shabbatot of the year. The holy books tell us that every Shabbat, the most opportune time to pray to God is Seudah Shlishit. The holy books refer to that moment as Ra'avad Ra'avin. That is the moments of mercy. That's why Seudah Shlishit is a very special time. All of us feel elevated when we come to the Derashah during Seudah Shlishit. We don't only feel elevated at the time of the Derashah because of what is being said, but because the moment is a very precious moment. It's the end of Shabbat. That's when the gates of heaven are open, and there's a tremendous amount of Kiddushah at that moment. But during the Shabbatot of the 3 weeks, the holy books bring down, the whole day is like Seudah Shlishit. The whole day is considered Ra'avad Ra'avin. The whole day has a tremendous Kiddushah, especially tomorrow's Shabbat, which is the Yahrzeit of Aharon HaKohen. Where in Shamayim, if we could see it, there's a lot of things going on, and there's a big push to redeem the Jewish people. Aaron comes to God tomorrow and says, God, you said in the Torah, when the Kohen Gadol dies, people go out of exile. Today's my own side. Free the people. Now, although Mashiach can't come on Shabbat, so tomorrow, Sunday morning, let him go. Free them already. It's 2,000 years. Bikseh Edom. I died at the exile of Edom. I died on the border. This is the symbolism that's being said over here. If we're talking about this subject already, I'd like to say an allusion that I heard from the great Rabbi Rav Chida. I actually saw it, but I didn't hear it. The rabbi lived about 500 years ago. It says at the beginning of the parasha, the first four words, Ele Mas'eh B'nei Yisrael. These are the travelings of the Jewish people. And he says, four words, four exiles. Ele, you know what the Aleph stands for? Edom. That's the exile of Edom. Mem, that's the exile of Madai. Bet, that's the exile of Bavel. Yud, that's the exile of Yavan. Ele Mas'e B'nei Yisrael, these are the travelings of the Jewish people. The Torah's predicting they're going to travel into four separate exiles. Edom, Madai, Bavel, Yavan. And if you look at the notes, one of the classes in Brooklyn, we talked about the notes of the words. Not only the words themselves, but the tunes that we sing each word. How important is it for the Hazan not only to read the words correctly, but to sing it correctly? Every word in the Torah has a note. You know what the note on the word Ele? It's called the Girish. You know what a girish? You know what girish means? Legaresh, to kick out, to be exiled. On the pasuk that alludes to the four exiled, the name of the note is called girish. And then the next notes are called shofar holech ravia. Holech means to go, ravia is four. The Jewish people are going to be ousted, girish, holech ravia. They're going to have to walk and traverse through four exiles. Look how the Ta'amin give us a story. And we are in this forced exile, which is quickly coming to an end. Don't believe anybody that gives you predictions. I heard from a great rabbi, people who predict don't know. We have to learn that rule. The people who know don't talk. But it is clear that this is imminent. As I said, the signs are here. And I want to tell you now a story that you're well familiar with, but an insight that I don't think you're familiar with. You righteous ladies have gone to so many classes, and you've heard the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. I know the story is coming out of your ears already. You know it by heart, you know all the details, and you've heard every interpretation and every concept, and the story has been so squeezed and so delved into. And you wonder yourself, that's the only story, there's no other story. But if the Talmud tells us that that's one of the contributing factors of the destruction, you have to learn that story good. And we've discussed it in previous years, but I want to offer to you maybe the most important and profound interpretation, just to review for myself, to remind myself of the episode. There was a fellow making a party, and he had a friend called Kamsa, he had an enemy called Bar Kamsa. Invitations got mixed up. Instead of inviting his friend, he invited his enemy, his arch enemy. Bar Kamsa gets the invitation. He's shocked that he's even invited. He attends the wedding, he attends the party. Rabbis happen to be invited to the party as well. He sits down, he's eating at the buffet, whatever it may be. The host sees his enemy at the party, he cannot tolerate it. He tells him, please, you got to get out of here. Do me a favor, you're making your scene, you're embarrassing me. Let me just pay, cover it, whatever I ate over here. And don't make a stink. He says, make a stink, I don't want your $52, get out of here. And he throws him out. The guy says, please, before you make a big to-do, you're embarrassing me, I'll pay for half the party. I need your money, I don't need your money, I'll pay for the whole party. Get out of here, scram, he throws him out. The fellow leaves the party and takes a direct flight from the party in Jerusalem to Rome. He gets to Rome, he goes to the Caesar, he tells the Caesar, the Jewish people have rebelled against you. He himself was Jewish, but he was like a renegade. The Caesar said, what do you mean the Jewish people have rebelled against me? And he starts to malign the Jewish people. He's an informer. He went to the government and informed on the Jewish people. And the Caesar believes him. And from that episode, from Bar Kamsa getting thrown out of the party, the Gemara says that began the spiraling downfall of Am Yisrael and led to the destruction of our temple. Unbelievable story. But we have to analyze it correctly. Everybody always analyzes the part of Bar Kamsa, the poor guy. Hazit, the guy came to the party. He got an invitation, so what do you want from the guy? He's minding his own business, he's eating. That rotten host came along and throws him out. Heartless guy. Who would do such a thing? Let the guy eat, let the guy stay. We would, it's unimaginable to do such a kick a guy out of your party. Especially he's begging for clemency. He's begging, please, you're making a scene. And the guy is ruthless, the host. Get out of my party. He doesn't even hear his pleas. But I have to tell you information, ladies, that you might not, it's not so obvious. Bar Kamsa is one of the worst Jews that ever lived. Look what this man did. He went to Rome and he jeopardized the safety of the entire Jewish people. Bar Kamsa is not a good guy. He's a villain. And let me tell you another secret. He didn't become a villain the moment he got thrown out of the party. You don't become a villain overnight. What, you think a person just becomes a rasha, a criminal in a second? He was a criminal from the get-go. The man was the worst guy. And let me tell you another secret. That's why the host was throwing him out, because he knew who this guy was. He knew this guy wasn't a good guy. He knew he was a bum. He was a gangster. I'll tell you another secret. That's why the rabbis didn't say anything. You have to picture, imagine the guy's making a party. You have the great rabbi sitting at the dais. And who walks in? A skinhead. And the guy's sitting there and he's eating the kibbeh. And I'm like, what are you doing here, skinhead? The guy comes, he's an SS officer that day. The guy, the worst guy, the guy comes in, he's a Ku Klux Klan. He comes in with his funny hat, with the pointed the white hat, and he's wearing a white robe. Ku Klux Klan member sitting at the party. So the guy says, hey, what are you doing here? I have an invitation. What are you, invitation? You skinhead, get out of here. Lasha. I mean, the guy was a villain at the party. He wasn't a good guy. That's why the rabbi said, don't say anything. This guy's Lasha. Throw him out. Get him out of here. So now you think to yourself, so what was the problem? The host was right. The host did something that we would probably do also. Somebody that doesn't belong, especially somebody that's a bad person, somebody that's a dangerous person, and you see how dangerous he was. But you know what the lesson is of the story? You knew the guy's a dangerous guy. You knew maybe not to what extent he was going to do what he did, but you knew that he was dangerous and he was capable of causing harm. You know what the problem of the host was? He did not calculate what could happen. He acted on impulse. He got angry, he got emotional. Get out of my house. But think for a second, you know who you're throwing out? This guy over is a troublemaker. He can make life miserable for us. Now again, I don't say that he knew he was going to go to Rome. Nobody can imagine that. But you know the guy's a troublemaker. He can make trouble for the rabbis. He can make trouble for the Jewish people. Who knows? He's influential. Let the guy just eat. But we know you don't want him at the party. But sometimes you have to overcome your impulse. And you have to overcome your knee-jerk reaction, because you have to know every action has a reaction. And there's always a consequence. And therefore you always have to forecast, if I do this, what is it going to set into motion? You know what the avon of the host was? He acted on impulse. And when people act on impulse, they bring destruction. When they don't think they're the ways out, when they don't analyze what can come out, they bring a destruction to themselves, and it can even be a destruction to the entire world. So that means, if we crystallize what I'm telling you now, the destruction was because of impulsive behavior. Dear ladies, we are living in a country, at a time, where every one of us, to a certain degree, has been affected by impulsive behavior. This is one of the Yetzer Hara of our generation, where the Yetzer Hara wants us to act and then think. Do it now, and then you'll worry about the consequences. Our nation is built on buy now, pay later. We are constantly being seduced by the market. Take it now, you don't have to pay for it. You'll pay in 6 months from now, don't worry about it. No interest, no anything. 6 months is an eternity. I could take something home from a store for free, I don't have to pay for it, nothing. Just sign it, sign your name over here, we're not going to even bother you for 6 months. So people act on impulse. And they spend money that they don't have. And they overextend themselves. And they keep on indulging and conspicuous consumption. And they're continuing to live a very big lifestyle. Because they're always saying, okay, we'll worry about it later. And then when later comes, all of a sudden their bubble bursts. And they can't pay for this lifestyle. And they can't afford this lifestyle that they lived in. And that brings themselves to destruction of their personal lives. Whether they have to sell their homes as a result and sell their assets, all because why? Because you lived beyond your means. You lived more than you're able to afford. And this is what's happening in this generation. I don't know if you listen to the news or not, but our economy in this country is going through a great stress. What brought this stress on? Besides the spiritual reasons that we know God has his hezbonot, but there's economic understanding as well. I'm not an economist, but I understand a little. It's because everybody got excited. There was a lot of money available. There was a lot of money. Banks were giving out money for free. Just for the asking. Just sign your name. And everybody was taking all this money that they had no idea how they're going to pay it back. But the banks were telling, don't worry about it. Just take it. They were buying homes that were worth maybe a quarter of their real value. But if you're thinking to yourself, you say, it can't be. If the house is only worth 100 and I'm taking a loan for 500, and if I can't pay this loan back, it's only worth 100, if the bank cannot sell it, they're going to lose money, I'm going to be in foreclosure. Nobody thought. Just buy, purchase, spend, waste. And now as a result of all this impulsive behavior of our country and of our people, now everything settles down. Now everybody's feeling the pain. They asked the rabbis in Pirkei Avot, what is the greatest trait you can have? So one rabbi said, the best trait, lev tov, a good heart. So they asked him, what's the worst trait you can have? He said, lev ra, a bad heart. Oh, very good. They asked the next rabbi, what's the best trait you could have, or the best situation you could have? You know what he said? Shechen tov, a good neighbor. In another class, I'll tell you the value of good neighbors. Neighbors are everything. So they asked the same rabbi, what's the worst trait? Shechen ra, bad neighbors. Oh, if you have bad neighbors, you have to live with your neighbors. No good. They asked the next rabbi, what's the best trait? He said, ayin tov, oh, a good eye, a generous eye. And they asked the same rabbi, what's the worst trait? He said, ayin ra'ah, a bad eye. Well, that makes sense. And then they went and asked the fourth rabbi, he said, rabbi, what's the best trait a person can have? Haro'eh et hanolad. Somebody that's able to see the future. Somebody, a fortune teller? Somebody that has a crystal ball? Who can see the future? Very few people can see the future. What he meant to say is somebody that acts today with thinking that what he does today is going to have an effect on the future. Somebody that contemplates his actions. Somebody that doesn't just act recklessly. Somebody that's measured. Somebody that's balanced. Haro'eh et hanolad. If I do this, it's going to cause this. If I act in this way, there's going to be a reaction that way. That's the greatest trait that a person can have, that he's able to forecast, not a future, but he's able to make balanced decisions. He can see the outcome of his actions. And they asked the same rabbi, what's the worst trait a person can have? So you'd figure he'd say, somebody that doesn't see the future. He didn't say that. He says, you know what the worst guy is? Somebody that borrows money and doesn't pay back. So the rabbis ask, is that the opposite of not seeing the future? Of not seeing consequences? And the rabbis say, yes it is. You know why? A person borrows money. Before he borrows the money, he has to have a plan. How is he going to pay it back? You can't just borrow money recklessly because somebody's generous on the other side of the table. He has to figure it out. Well, I make this much money a year. If I put this much money on the side, if I save over here, if I don't travel this year, if I'll cut back on some of my pleasures. You have to have a game plan how to play back. Somebody that borrows money, he just says, give me the money, I'll worry about it later. You worry about it later. And then when the time comes, he tells him, I don't know, I don't have the money, what am I going to do? You just took money and you didn't forecast a few years out that you're not going to be able to pay this back? That's the worst trait. Haloveh ve'enu mishalem is the opposite of haro'eh tanolad. Now, I agree, if somebody borrows money and has a plan and something happened, okay, we agree, something happened, okay, it was out of his control. But to just take money and spend money and... we'll worry about it when it happens. This brings destruction to families. This brings destruction to people. And this is bringing destruction to our country. The great democracy and capitalism. But when people just go on a wild spending spree and a buying spree, but nothing belongs to them. Their homes don't belong to them, they belong to the bank. Their cars don't belong to them, they belong to the bank. Nothing is theirs. Our grandparents didn't live that way. Our grandparents lived according to their means. If they were able to afford a car, they bought that car. And if they couldn't afford the car, they didn't buy it. Today it's very easy. I go lease a car. I can't afford a $60,000 or $70,000, $100,000 Rolls Royce. I can't afford it, but I can afford $1,000 a month. So I'm driving a car that I can't afford, but I can afford $12,000 a year to drive to make myself like I'm a rich man. So it's all fake. And now what is this country saying? The car maker said yesterday, we're not letting people lease cars anymore. Because it's getting out of hand. They're giving the car back. We can't resell the car. It's ruining the whole economy. This facade of people spending what they don't have. It has to catch up. Don't you understand, ladies? All this has to catch up. And this is what happened. When a country was being led by that mentality of just do it now. Don't worry about it. But it doesn't make sense. Don't worry about it. A few years before, people were buying stocks. Stocks on the stock market. But the stocks didn't have any value to them. Internet companies, they had no value. They were just a piece of paper. They didn't even have a company. People were spending $60 a share, $100 a share. You bought the stock in 2 days, it split, it's a triple. People going out of their mind. And the big economists were saying, what are the people doing? They're in for a big surprise. You see, when the tide is high, nobody ever imagines that there'll be low tide. You can't imagine. Look how high the waves are. It'll never happen. All of a sudden, when the tide comes low, you say, what happened over here? And that's what happened. People were buying air. They said, it's unbelievable. There's a new hadush. You can buy air for $50 a share, and it goes up the next day. It's simple. But when everything settled down, and the bubble burst, and you're holding on to air, and now you realize the value is nothing. But again, that mentality of, you didn't contemplate, you didn't analyze, you didn't think it out. Just, you're running, you're spending, you're buying. And now we're hurting because of this. I want to tell you something. When the economy is good, and this is a very important rule, you never think it could be bad. When somebody's making money, they never think that they're not going to make money anymore. When the pipe of Hashem is open and money's coming down the pipe, you never think that the pipe can close. You never anticipate it, because in years of plenty, you think that the plenty will last forever. The wise man says, even in the year of plenty, calm down. Life is cyclical. No economy remains robust forever. And therefore, you have to be calm even in the times of plenty. That was the greatness of Yosef HaSadiq. Yosef told Paro, there's going to be 7 years of plenty. He didn't say it's just 7 years of good, 7 years of plenty. That means the economy of Egypt is going to be so blessed. There's going to be a tremendous amount of beracha. 7 years of sava. Sava is plenty. A lot of product. But it's going to be followed by the 7 years of famine. And know what Yosef said? You know what the biggest challenge is going to be? To get the people to conserve in the 7 years of plenty. Because they're not going to understand it. How could you? What do you conserve? Look at the beracha that we have. So he says, that's going to be our biggest challenge. So you know what he did? He set up ration stations. Now picture the scene. You have an abundance of food, and it's coming in, and there's silos of wheat and everything, and now you have to stand online, and Yosef tells the guy, okay, here's one box of spaghetti. What do you want, one box? I want 20 boxes. You can't have 20 boxes. What do you mean? But look at this beracha. In 7 years from now, you're going to understand why I'm giving you one box now. What are you talking about? But when the 7 years of famine hit, there was food left in the cupboard over there, because Yosef understood. He was ro'et ha'nolad. He anticipated the future. So I told this concept to the men. The men said, I'm shocked. I'm coming to a Torah class. You're talking about how much I should spend my money. How I should become a little more conservative in my spending. Rabbi, but you're too late. You should have told us this during the 7 years of plenty. Now it's already, the famine has begun, God forbid. But I'll tell you why. Because people still don't realize that we're beginning a change of economy. People are in denial of this. People want to think that everything is the same. Very hard for people to change their spending habits. If a person is used to spending a certain amount of money every week and buying a certain amount of things and having a certain amount of cars and going on a certain amount of vacations, I don't want to hear about the economy. The economy is for the guy in Wyoming. That's for the Americani guy in Arkansas somewhere that is living on a farm. I'm not a farmer. Economies don't affect me. I don't care what gas prices, I don't care fuel prices, I don't care food prices. I go on 4 vacations a year. I have this amount of cars, I have this amount of houses, I buy this amount of clothes. Don't confuse me now with the economy. I'm not an economist. I'm not Alan Greenspan, I'm not his successor, I don't know any of this stuff. All I know is I want this money. But you have to understand, ladies, just if you don't know it already, there has been a change in the lifestyle. And when people do not willing to change their spending habits, that means you're not predicting your future. God forbid, you could put, nobody here, but it can put families in great stress, not now, but in the future, because you're not anticipating it. When you're spending money that you don't have, this is a very dangerous habit. Because God forbid, it catches up. Everything has to catch up. There's no such thing as beating the system. It's just a matter of time when it catches up. And when it catches up, when the tide goes in, now what? And therefore, we're learning that the destruction of the temple was why? Because somebody didn't calculate what's going to be. Because the Baal HaBayit said, throw them out. But you're working on emotion. You can't go on emotion. Think, if you do this, what's going to happen? When people act on impulse, it destroys their lives. You have to work with brains. You have to work with sechel. Even if it means tightening up a little. Even if it means not buying everything. Even if it means once in a while, humble yourself. Even if you can afford it. Humble yourself and say, I can't afford it. It's not the worst thing to say those words. I can't. But we're too proud. We're too proud. Like, hospitals of somebody should say they can't afford something. What's the matter with saying you can't afford it? My parents couldn't afford a lot of things and they told it to me. I'm not worse off because of it. I'm better off because of it. Because we had restrictions, we had guidelines. But today, we're so fragile. Who would be willing to tell their child, I can't afford it? No, because we want kavod from our children. We don't want our children to think we're miskeen. We want kavod from a 4-year-old. No, honey, of course I could buy it for you. We're too embarrassed to tell a child, I can't afford it. What are you embarrassed for? You tell your children you can't afford something. A friend comes and asks you, and we're too embarrassed, I can't afford it. You have to afford everything? Everybody has to have money for everything, for every iron, to eat out as much as they want, to buy as much jewelry as they want, to go as much. This is why it's accepted fact. There's no such thing as not having money for something. But again, when the pressure is so strong, and you're living in a community where it's so strong, and the buying power is so strong, and the spending power is so strong, and the competition is so strong, so people start to act and live on impulse, and then when it catches up on them, trust me, ladies, when it catches up, it's much more embarrassing. It's much more embarrassing. Because just to say I couldn't afford and live a little simple, people can understand that. But when people live a very high lifestyle that they don't have, and then all of a sudden it crashes, they say, oh, what happened? Then it's a very embarrassing situation. People are spending money on parties. For what reason to spend all these money on parties? In a good economy, it's also wrong, in my opinion. Because you always have to be conservative. I'm not saying to be cheap. I'm not telling you to be cheap. Don't misunderstand. Rabbi said be frugal. I'm not telling you to that. Don't become a cheapskate. That's not my message to you today. I'm talking be conservative in your spending. Be a little more according to the economy. Which means you can't live according to the years of plenty in the years of famine. That's what I'm trying to tell you. And many of us do not want to recognize that we have entered a different phase. Now, I'm not saying we're not going to get out of it. This is cyclical, God willing. Just like economies change, things go up, things go down. But you can't just be like a roller coaster, just keep on going and nothing changed. We're still... That's impulse. And there's something to say about people that live according to their means. Trust me, it's a blessing. When a person lives according to their means, first of all, you're happier. Second of all, you're healthier. You don't have so much stress. You don't put pressures on yourself that you don't need. What's going to be with our children? We've created such a lifestyle, it's very difficult for our children to maintain this lifestyle. But again, we're not thinking. Just go, put, spend, build, do. I'll tell you one story with the Gaon of Vilna. To show you what does it mean. He was once in exile himself. He went on a self-imposed exile. And he says he stayed, He stayed by a person's house. He doesn't tell too many stories to Gaon Mevilna, but this story he liked to tell. He said, I was staying by a guy's house. The guy was impoverished. He had nothing. But he would have aniyim eating at his table. And I was wondering, where does the guy get food? He has no money, but everybody's eating fresh bread. He said, it came close to Shabbat, so I told the host, listen, I don't know where you're getting this food from. This bread, it's not too much food. But I cannot stay by you for Shabbat because it's an imposition. How can I stay for you Shabbat? I don't know where you're going to get the food from. He says, don't worry, Rabbi, everything's fine. Do I look under pressure? He says, no, absolutely not. But I don't understand how you do it. Not only are you feeding yourself, but you have poor people eating at your table. He says, listen, I made a deal with the baker. Every day he gives my wife the leftovers of the wheat and the chaff of the wheat that gets stuck in the millstone. So I go to all the millstones, I collect all the junk that they would throw away. My wife takes it, she grinds it up, she makes fresh bread. We're very happy, we eat it, and we have so much bread from this, we invite the poor people, they're thrilled, they get a fresh piece of hot bread, everybody's fine. Oh, and when Shabbat comes, me and my wife go Thursday to the butcher, and we work in the butcher. What do? We pluck the chickens from the feathers. It's not the most prestigious job, but we do it, we pluck the feathers, and as a result, how do we get paid? The butcher gives us the necks of the chicken and the legs of the chicken. The worst part. But we're thrilled. As I go home, me and my wife, we make two big bowls or pots of soup, chicken soup. One for Friday night and one for Shabbat. So the Gaon Mevilna says, when he told me this, even though it sounded very, very limited, but to him it made sense that he's happy. So I stayed for Shabbat. The Gaon says, I never saw a man so happy. He was sitting at his table like a king, and his wife brings out this chicken soup with the heads and the necks and the legs, and they're singing Pizmonim, and they're thrilled. The man was like a king in a palace, sitting around with all his servants. I never saw happiness like this before. And he said, you know why? Because he was a man that spent what he had, and he was happy with the ad, and he didn't put a pressure on himself, and he didn't go crazy, and he didn't self-inflict himself. He's a happy man. And this is where we're headed. We're going into these lifestyles which are very, very unsafe. Unsafe for health of the people, unsafe for the stability of our families. But I know you're all off now to the races, but just give me one more minute and then I'll conclude. I know that the hour is late. I want to just make one point. That was the claim against the host. You're right, you threw out a Ku Klux Klan member from your house. We know that. But why didn't you anticipate what he's capable of doing? Because you acted on emotion. Good. But the Gemara says, Akamsa Ubar Kamsa Achar of Yerushalayim. Jerusalem was not only destroyed on account of Bar Kamsa, this villain, but Kamsa as well. And I ask you, what do you want from Kamsa? He didn't do anything wrong. He was the poor guy that didn't get the invitation. He was the good guy in the story. He was the guy that got snubbed unintentionally. Why is he at fault? And you know what the explanation is? Kamsa, you didn't get an invitation. But you know the guy's your friend. It's your best friend. So you know something happened. The invitation got lost in the mail. Even though for some reason my electric bill never got lost in the mail, but invitations always get lost in the mail, but that's another story. But the point is, go to the party anyway. But Kamsa stood on principle. I didn't get an invitation, I'm not going. Okay, good. But you know what would have happened if he would have been a good guy and went anyway? If he would have gave his friend the benefit of that, you know what, private invitation got lost. I know he's inviting me, I know he didn't forget me. You know what would have happened if he would have went? When that host would have been screaming at that guy, you know what his friend would have told him? You're making a mistake. Because that's what friends do. Friends usually advise each other. When you see your friend doing something wrong at his party, what do you usually do? You go whisper in his ear, don't do that, go over there, put this there. Your dress is not good, fix the flowers, do it. Friends advise each other at these parties. If his best friend would have went at the party and would have seen him making the scene, he would have had brains, because his friend, the host, was working out of emotion. His friend could have had the sanity to tell him, listen, you're working out of emotion. Don't start with this guy. This guy's capable of a lot of trouble. And therefore, Kamsa, you're guilty also. Because if you would have been at the party, you could have been the the stabling factor behind the irate behavior of the host. You could have been the one that's ro'eh tanolad, where the host was unable to. And therefore, ladies, we must accept upon ourselves that sometimes the problems come because we self-inflict ourselves with these problems. Our spending habits have to change. It doesn't matter if you have a lot of money or a little money. Even in the times of plenty, people have to be a little more conservative. Certainty in the times of difficult times of economy. There's a lot of people that are hurting out there. You wouldn't know that unless it's yourself or people that you know. But as the rabbi, there's a lot of people that are hurting now. People that we cannot imagine. And if everybody has to be a little more, there's no mitzvah now to go spend money to show that even in a bad economy you can throw money away. There's no chokhmah, that's stupidity. But there's people like that. I want to show even in such an economy I could expect $1 million thrown in the garbage. What's for purpose? You're a genius. Foolishness. What are you proving? What? They're adding insult to injury now to the people that don't have anything. You want to show them even in this? Everybody has to calm down. Everybody has to calm down. The wasting and all just the indulgence. I'm not saying don't live. Of course you have to live, but there's a difference. Something changed here. And if we don't make the adjustment catches up on us. And that's the reason why the temple was destroyed. Because somebody did not calculate a consequence. Because somebody acted on an impulse that brought to destruction. May you be blessed with oshir, with wealth, so much wealth and so much health, health first and then wealth. Yishrab b'racha'at b'lidai. And be'azat Hashem, we should continue to have success and the rebuilding of our temple in our time. Amen.